Hello, this is The Review, a podcast from The Atlantic's culture team about movies, television, and all the things we make to entertain ourselves. I'm Sophie Gilbert. I'm a staff writer at The Atlantic, and I'm joined today by two other staff writers on our culture team, Megan Garber.
Hello.
And Hannah Georges. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, hello.
How are you both doing? What have you been reading, watching, listening to? What's cool? I don't know.
I started watching Hacks again, which has made me very happy.
Oh, so good.
And rewatching The Sex Lives of College Girls because I'm making friends watch it with me now. So I've been thoroughly enjoying both of those things.
Wait, I want to watch it with you. I've never seen that.
I do. Oh my God, you have to. Yeah. It's so sweet. And earnest and funny, and it really surprised me. And I feel bad for how much it surprised me.
I had kind of low expectations, I have to say, coming into it.
And
at every corner, it was just better than I anticipated, and so sweet and good.
Just utterly delightful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice to know. I don't know how to segue to our subject today, except to say that we're going to be doing a rewind this week. We are going back to 2007 to talk about the Judd Apatow comedy Knocked Up. The film turns 15 on June 1st, which I don't really want to acknowledge. It makes me feel older than I should be. This anniversary, we have to say, also arrives at a unique moment for the movie's subject. The recent leak of a draft decision revealed that a 5-vote conservative majority on the US Supreme Court is willing to overturn Roe v. Wade. The final decision won't arrive till June, but as it stands right now, it's fair to expect that abortion rights around the country will be severely curtailed. So we wanted to use this episode to explore how Hollywood shapes our conversations about pregnancy, abortion, and we thought Knocked Up in particular is an interesting way to look at the subject. It's a massively successful movie about an unwanted pregnancy in which the word abortion never actually appears.
Tell me you don't want him to get an A word.
Yes, I do, and I won't say it for little baby ears over there, but it rhymes with schmushmortion.
Megan wrote an amazing piece about Knocked Up last week and about the many flaws that we will be moving on to discuss now. But to get back to my question, Megan, like, how have your thoughts on it changed, if at all?
I actually don't remember seeing Knocked Up at all, whether it was in a theater, in sort of the Netflix, you know, magic DVDs that would appear at your house. But what I can definitely say is that I was very much struck in this viewing, perniciousness in the guise of comedy. And, you know, I think a lot of things that we'll probably be talking about in this episode. But yeah, it sort of has that kind of haze of like omnipresence in my mind, where it just sort of, you know, in some ways has existed forever. And in some ways, you know, never started and never ended. It's just kind of there. What about you, Hannah?
Yeah, very much the same. I have no distinct concrete memories of going to watch it, no memories of like talking about it with people. And yet I know that I did definitely watch it, because when we went, when I rewatched it recently, like there were moments that I was having like deja vu, or just remembering like, oh yeah, how did I feel about this in real time? And I couldn't quite conjure it, but I know I had experienced any number of things that happened in the movie before. So it wasn't like my first time seeing the weird exchanges between Paul Rudd's character and Leslie Mann's. Like, it just all of that.
It's so true. It's one of those movies, rewatching it, I was struck by the fact that I didn't remember the beginning. It's one of the films that so often you like are browsing and you put on and it's like showing on, I don't know, whatever terrible network. And so I was like, oh, this movie has a start. But yeah, I remember at the time, I think I watched it with a really terrible boyfriend at the time, or a guy I was seeing who thought this Miss Motion line was really funny. Mm. And I was like, what? Oh. We'll do a brief rundown of the movie. Katherine Heigl plays Alison Scott, a producer on E! Television, who gets promoted to on-air talent in a kind of hilarious scene with Kristen Wiig, which is actually one of the highlights of the movie for me.
If we're gonna
be ruthless about it, I should say I really love that scene. And while celebrating out in a club one night with her sister, played by Leslie Mann, the director Judd Apatow's real-life wife, she meets Ben, played by Seth Rogen. It makes no sense that they talk to each other, let alone have sex, but they do. And 8 weeks later, Alison finds out that she is pregnant. So, Megan, what I took away from your piece is just kind of the weird absence of Alison as a character with any desires, motivations, dreams, goals. Mm-hmm. She's very passive. She lives in her sister's pool house. She gets promoted by no apparent effort of her own. And then she gets pregnant. And then there's no real discussion of her thoughts about what to do. So, like, tell me, both of you, what do you make of Allison? Like, what? How do we think of her? What is she, just a foil for the men in this movie to have a cool, fun time around?
I think that's a pretty good, pretty good summary of things. Yeah. Actually, I mean, I think that, you know, this movie is in so many ways, it's a rom com for sure. It's a buddy comedy. It's a raunch comedy. It's a lot of things at once. But I think you can also look at it as kind of a modern fairy tale in a lot of ways. You know, and in the movie's defense, a little bit, these aren't just characters; they are tropes. You know, there's a lot of sort of like, you know, turning these people into ideas and all that kind of stuff. And I wouldn't mind that so much if the terms were so sort of unevenly split. So, you know, Sophie, to your point, like, I think, you know, you might think in a movie about pregnancy, the character who is sort of centered and elevated and celebrated and all of that would be Allison. And I think, in fact, it is Ben. And I think again and again, sort of the movie's like empathies and gravities and everything are aimed at Ben. And this question of this sort of man-child slacker guy who's very charming, but, you know, kind of stuck in arrested development. And, you know, the question in this movie, as in so many of Judd Apatow's films, is, you know, about growing up. And the question is not, will Allison grow up? The question is, will Ben grow up? And I think one of the things that I found pretty pernicious, really, in my viewing of the movie this time around, is that Allison, like, serves as kind of a vessel and a means to help Ben grow up and to help Ben become an adult and a father. And she really is, yeah, written out of so much, because her role is fundamentally just to be kind of an instrument for someone else's development.
It's strange the extent to which the movie equates Ben growing up, Ben stepping up, Ben becoming a man because he is going to become a father, with Allison's need to, like, loosen up. Right? Like, these are, they're charted as these sort of like two equally urgent needs, two equally urgent paths of growth. And, you know, you step back for a second, it's like, okay, wait, hold on. Something here is not quite right. There's a scene, you know, toward, like, as the birth scene is imminent, when it becomes clear, you know, he sort of recites a fact that makes it become clear that he's read, you know, a single thing about pregnancy and what's happening to Allison's body, that Allison and that the film sort of by proxy really, like, celebrates in this way that I remember feeling like, okay, well, that seems a little bare minimum to me. and watching it again, it is really striking the extent to which his growth arc is like learning some stuff about pregnancy and about adulthood. And hers is like learning to congratulate him for learning some stuff about pregnancy and adulthood, right?
Yeah. I went back and I was reading a profile of Judd Apatow that came out in 2007. And it was a very thoughtful profile. He seemed like a kind of strikingly troubled man at the time for someone who was 39, the toast of Hollywood, happily married, had two gorgeous kids, like, which is, you know, not to say that those things don't allow you to sort of have anxiety and to suffer with, you know, self-image or whatever. But the things I really took away from the profile is the way he was talking about, like, the nerd's fantasy involved in the kinds of films that he made, the kinds of films that Knocked Up exemplified at the time. Like, and I think his quote was, as a nerd, representing nerds, we all wish that somebody would take the time to get to know us and love us, warts and all, which I thought was really telling, because basically in the movie, like, the message in the movie is, it's not that he needs even to change necessarily. Like, he does grow up and in the end embrace fatherhood and get an apartment and get a job and, you know, have the capacity to pay for things with money. And I think probably get a cell phone, you know. He is, shall we say, fairly, fairly bad at life in the beginning of the film.
I'm Canadian. I live here illegally, actually. It works out in my advantage, I think, ultimately, because I don't have to pay any taxes. So, financially, that's helpful. I mean, I'm not poor or anything, but I eat a lot of spaghetti.
And the message of the movie is not that men like this need to change. It's that women need to take the time to sort of excavate the diamonds that they can be from underneath the mess of marijuana haze and arrested development. and that the other thing that struck me when I was watching the movie again is, like, there's no single woman in this film that you would want to hang out with. Like, there's really, really not. Like, Allison, she's fine. You know, she's not super chill or funny. She's not really given anything entertaining or charming to do in the movie. Her sister is incredibly uptight. The contrast in the scenes between when Allison's is having lunch with her mother to discuss the pregnancy and her mother's like, honey, just get rid of it. You know, it happened to your stepsister and then she had a real baby. And you're like, oh my God. And then the contrast with Seth Rogan's with Ben telling his dad, who's played by beloved Harold Ramis from Ghostbusters, and he's like, I'm gonna be a grandfather. It just kind of exemplifies the contrast between, like, the men in this movie, adorable, the women, pretty bad all around.
Think about your stepsister. Now, you remember what happened with her? She had the same situation as you, and she had it taken care of. And you know what? Now she has a real baby.
Well, one of the things, too, about that sort of contrasting pair of scenes is that Ben, in the conversation with his father, has the line, I had a vision for how my life would go, and this definitely is not it. You know, in talking about this impending pregnancy, which, I mean, that's a very powerful line, in a, you know, particularly in a movie about an unintended pregnancy. And it's very striking that the line was given to Ben and not to Allison. And, you know, back to your point, Sophie, too, I mean, the film, like, as it is presenting those conversations between, you know, the children and their parents, essentially, you know, it that is part of a scene that just kind of tumbles over, you know, the aftermath of Allison's realization that she's pregnant. And we never get the scene where Allison actually decides, you know, that she is going to keep the baby. That is just completely edited out. And it really is striking, just like you both have been saying, just kind of the absence and, you know, everything that has been edited out of this film, you know, to just maybe make it move along more quickly. But then again, we have at the very beginning this lengthy, you know, very casual scene of men being men and all this stuff. So you don't get the impression that the film is really interested in time saving and all that stuff. So, yeah. And I, one other thing, too, just related to that, that I found so fascinating is, so in the scene with Allison and her mom, that scene also starts one of the things that this movie does, which is to sort of metabolize Allison's anxieties about the pregnancy, like through discussions of weight. Like, oh, again, my God. And again in the movie, yes. When Allison, she doesn't say, I'm fearful about this process. I'm nervous about what this is going to mean for my life. You know, anything that she might be thinking or feeling about becoming a parent is processed as, oh no, I'm going to get fat.
Fat in the face, jowls, fat ass. Debbie didn't get fat. Debbie is a freak of nature.
And it could have worked and been saying something insightful about the nature of her work as on-air talent now, right? Like, it, there's a world in which, like, it could have ended and been serving something, and yet it extends so far, like into even, you know, her big apology to Ben toward the end.
I'm so sorry I broke up with you. I was just in such a panic from all of this, and watching Debbie and Pete together, and my ass got so fat. No. It did.
And the very end of her apology is, and my ass got so fat. And it's,
oh,
like, okay, so that made her behave in this way that we're supposed to believe is irrational because she was so distraught and angry about, of all things, her ass getting fat. And it's just, it just feels, you know, that moment just felt, one, in looking back at this after 15 years, after the way that the body trends, et cetera, have shifted, it feels particularly ridiculous to hear. But it does feel really outrageous, right? That, like, of all the things that she's listing as reasons that she might have been under duress in this incredibly complicated, difficult time in her life, the number one thing, or the sort of thing she lands on, is this change to her body, to her weight. And it's not about her child, but that is about, again, sort of desirability and the way that she's supposed to look as a woman, and particularly as a white woman, right?
Yeah, that's such a good point. She's not worried about money. She's not like, how am I going to pay for this? Who's going to be the nanny? Where am I going to live? Like,
right.
Where will the baby sleep? Like, all the practical things that you completely lose your mind over. You're right. It's purely through the lens of weight.
Yeah.
That's depressing. The other thing that really struck me rewatching too was that when she finds out she's pregnant, the first thing she does is go to the doctor, and the doctor immediately does a sonogram, which is a very emotional thing. It's something that lots of states compel women who are seeking abortions to do, precisely because it's so emotional. It's different to consider a pregnancy once you have seen and heard a heartbeat. Like, it's just so immediately, again, like, the film is shifting into this very, like, I want to say culturally conservative gear, where it's like, but look, there's a baby, there's a heartbeat, there's a tiny thing right there. You know, and the fact that that precedes any discussion from Allison about what she's going to do, and then even really overrides it. I did want to just briefly address the ludicrousness of this setup. Like, There's no world in which these two people would meet at a club, I think. I mean, maybe there's a world in which they would go home together, but there is no world in which every step of this movie plays out exactly the way it does. Like, it is, like you said, Megan, it's an inverted fairy tale. It's like fantasy from a male point of view. Like, does that bother you guys?
Oh, right. Yes. Well, and I think too, I was just remembering back to what is now my, I think, officially least favorite scene in this movie of scenes that I, many of them I don't like, you know, because the movie doesn't just sort of present Ben as, you know, a slacker and everything you said, Sophie, but it also presents him as just a thoroughly, almost aggressively good guy. And I think goes out of its way almost acrobatically to, you know, to justify and rationalize everything he does. So, you know, the scene I'm thinking of is the scene where the pregnancy actually happens, where they are together at Allison's pool house. Ben is fumbling with the condom, and Allison, who has one of her first moments of just utter kind of illogical shrewishness that just kind of flips all of the sudden into her character, but she says, my God, just do it already, very impatiently. And he says, okay, and throws the condom away. She had clearly meant, please just hurry up with the condom. And this is the sort of, you know, elemental misunderstanding that informs the rest of the plot. The fact that the movie sort of puts all of the consequences and sort of moral weight of that scene on Allison just being impatient and being a little bit of a shrew, I think is very sort of revealing about what it's up to, about, you know, just sort of its general plot line, but particularly when it comes to Ben, because what did ensue, she clearly did not mean, please, you know, throw away the condom, you know, and that is a massive violation. And yet the film presents it as just another joke, you know, and obviously things have to happen in this way for the plot to play out as it does, but they also have to happen in this way for the film to preserve the idea that Ben is fundamentally a good guy, that Ben has no fault in this, that Ben is just doing what she asked and being accommodating, like he will be throughout the rest of the movie. And I just, it's interesting to me how much it had to contort to sort of rationalize Ben and sort of keep him in the sort of good guy frame of things.
Yeah. It's really interesting too, because when Allison learns that, when Ben tells Allison what had happened, like his reaction is very angry. It's very hostile. Yeah. He's like, what did you think I was doing? Of course, like, blah, 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 blah. What did you, like, could you not tell that we weren't, there was no condom?
Why the fuck didn't you stop me once we started?
I don't know. I couldn't tell that you didn't have one on, obviously. Oh, no. I was drunk.
Was your vagina drunk? Do you think it's the thinnest condom on earth I have on? I'm a fucking inventor. I mean, a dick skin condom.
It's really hostile. And you're like, oh my God. Yeah. We're still expected to root for this guy who essentially just stealthed a woman and is now angry at her for having become pregnant.
Yeah, and just calling her essentially stupid, right? Like, there's a whole thing where he's like weirdly graphic and hostile, as you're saying, Sophie, and just like felt gross to watch. And I was thinking about that in contrast with Catastrophe.
Oh,
the British series that starts off also with an unintended pregnancy that brings two very different people together. And I thought in watching Catastrophe, and I thought again, especially watching Knocked Up, that like Catastrophe would not work as a show, would not work as a premise if Rob were even like 10% less good. The show, I don't think the show paints him as being good in a way that's unfair, good in a way that's like overly virtuous as compared to like how the character actually plays out. But it's really remarkable to think about how differently he behaves as opposed to Ben in this. And granted, they're at very different positions in life, and also like that should factor into the plot, into how the women in these works are responding to them, and yet it doesn't entirely.
I did want to talk about the movie's treatment of abortion as a kind of non-option, and about the film industry's treatment of pregnancy and abortion from around that time, because later in 2007, obviously, came Juno, Diablo Cody's movie about a pregnant teenager played by Elliot Page, who ultimately decides to go through with her pregnancy and give the baby up for adoption to a very nice lady played by Jennifer Garner. But I think it was debated at the moment that both these movies made specific choices, and it really wasn't until 7 years later that Jenny Slate made the movie Obvious Child, which presented, shall we say, a different choice. Hannah, I know you rewatched that movie recently. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. In Obvious Child, Jenny Slate plays a kind of very aspiring stand-up comedian who is recently dumped by, her long-term boyfriend. And in the fallout of that, meets a stranger, has a similar setup, right? What appears to be either a one-night stand or sort of a short-term encounter, and then later finds out that she is pregnant and spends, a decent amount of the movie at least thinking through or talking through or sort of feeling her way through what is a potential way forward, and then navigating the logistics of it. And ultimately, the film ends with her having the abortion. It's not a big dramatic thing. And afterward, I think they watch she and the man who got her pregnant end up watching a movie or something. It just sort of ends with hey, here's these people at home as she's recovering from a medical procedure that she'd had earlier in the day. Like I said, there's not a big to-do about it all. She has a conversation about what this would have looked like if this had happened to her, 40, 50 years ago. But even that isn't super heavy-handed. It's just here's a woman who obviously is not prepared in any number of ways to be a mother in this exact moment. And so she makes the decision that makes sense for her in that time.
I remember that movie feeling pretty revolutionary at the time, which is funny because it's so not. Do you know what I mean?
One of the things I really did love about it, though, I just recently rewatched it in the context of, capital A, capital T, all this. I thought it was so beautiful and subtle the way it presented her character as, she's the obvious child in so many ways. She is just, she's immature in so many ways, but she is also so just charming and singular. And there is something just so lovely and compelling about that character. And I think the movie just in this very, just very soft, tender way conveys the idea of how just full of potential she is. You want to see what happens with her. You want to see what she does with her life. You know that she's in sort of a down period now, but that period will end and she's going to do amazing things, whatever amazing means to her in particular, and just the idea of her being entitled to discover that for herself, being entitled to sort of have that journey on her own terms, to sort of realize her talents and her own, just kind of quirk and singularity. The way that the movie is just sort of infused with that idea, I just found so powerful right now. It's such a quiet, lovely argument, but I think it's an argument that's there throughout the film. And I found that really remarkable.
Yeah, it's really interesting also too, as a budding comedian with an intense amount of charisma, who's extremely endearing. She really runs parallel to characters played by Seth Rogen, shall
very
we
much
say?
So. Very much so.
Right. They have much in common.
This is exactly what our baby will look like. It's a beautiful picture. It is. It's not bad. Hello, mommy. Our baby's going to be French-Canadian.
With a little hint of Spanish.
Exactly. I'm not good with accents.
I want to talk about the smishmotion scene. I don't really know how to bring it up. It's so telling, shall we say, that this is a movie in which abortion is like Voldemort. People can't even say it out loud. It's the medical procedure, a very common medical procedure that shall not be named. Why is it such a taboo in this movie?
I mean, it very much might be just sort of, marketing and sort of generally capitalistic concerns. But I just, to sort of just take the movie on its own terms, I would say that, this is a film that it is really conservative. The upshot is family is wonderful. Anything that gets you to family is good. I think it's really telling that, you could say, for example, this is just a comedy. Why are you paying so much attention to just a comedy? It doesn't matter. But I think it's really revealing that in this comedy that is so self-consciously a comedy too, everything about it sort of makes a joke about literally everything. But also Judd Apatow's daughters, are actors in this movie. His wife is an actor in the movie. The end of the film, the closing credits, show family photos of cast and crew, either as children or with their own children. The final scene of sort of the movie proper shows Allison and Ben with their daughter as treacly music plays, and it's family photos. And, the notion is everything worked out because there is now a new baby in the world. And that is the fundamental, I think, message of this film. And so I think if your assumption is baby equals good, and that is the beginning and the end of the discussion, you can't really allow or entertain anything that would come between that message. And so I think that that's, you know, that's a big part of it. And then also, of course, you know, just cultural notions of shame and, you know, a lot of these things that are still part of the abortion conversation, despite all the progress that's been made, you know, that in sort of, especially in mass culture, the way abortion is talked about, you know, there's always a little bit of a caveat, always a little bit of a, you know, euphemism invoked and all that kind of stuff. So I think there's a lot happening with the absence, but I think, yeah, I don't think that the movie is structured in a way that would allow it to talk about abortion as a legitimate or simply medical option.
Right, because there's that scene of Ben holding the baby toward the end, right? Like after the baby has arrived, and he's sort of talking to the baby, who I think is asleep, and, you know, Allison's meant to be asleep or maybe overhearing a little bit of it, and it's part of what endears her to him or whatever. They're doing that whole montage of her, like, being in love with him now because he is making gestures toward competent fatherhood. Anyway, in that in that context, he's talking to the baby and relaying that initial sort of condom confusion, as the film paints it.
Then your mommy said, just do it already, which was very confusing to Daddy. So I listened to the most literal translation of that, and I just did it already. What would you do?
It's really, really on the nose. Yes. And I was almost surprised by it. I don't know why. But even in the context of a film that is really, really clear about, like, baby is good. Baby is good even if circumstances are confusing or bad.
Don't tell mommy, but it was the smartest thing I ever did listening to her, because now you're here. Isn't that nice? I think it is.
The rationalizing away of the, again, like, quote-unquote confusion, as the film explains it, regarding the condom was really jarring, in particular as it's being explained to an infant, a newborn. But it's just this, yeah, like, you can't have a film with that scene or that sort of ends on that note be a film in which abortion is a serious and genuinely reckoned with option. How do you rationalize those two things in the same film? Which is wild, considering that this is also a film that really discusses women's bodies as their parts, yeah. Right? Like, there's, I mean, the actual birth scene is really where to begin. But this is a film in which, you know, Ben's work, what Ben is doing in an attempt to someday have work at first, is building a website with his friends in which they, you know, they identify and then list every moment at which, you know, a celebrity, a woman, is nude or is in some way revealing some part of her body in film.
fleshofthestars.com.
Thank you. I was like, it's not Mr. Skin, that's the competitor. Why did that stick in my brain? This is a film in which, you know, the romantic lead works on that kind of a website, and we get lots of details and lots of, like, information about the inner workings of the men who are sort of, like, goofy, like, stoners, whatever, putting together this website and talking about women's bodies again in this, like, really, like, sort of piecemeal, reducing them to their parts type way. And yet there is an inability to reckon with what women have to deal with. And so it just, that I just found that particularly stark, and that the scene of Ben laying that out for the newborn was pretty, I don't know, it just felt like a very clear thesis from the film.
It's interesting because there is such a strain of, like, angry defensiveness among all the men in this movie. And yeah. It was mirrored, shall we say, by the star and the filmmaker in the reaction to Katherine Heigl's criticism of it in 2008. Yeah. She was interviewed by Vanity Fair. She said, it was a little sexist. It paints the women as shrews, as humorless and uptight, and it paints the men as lovable, goofy, fun-loving guys. It exaggerated the characters, and I had a hard time with it on some days. I'm playing such a bitch. Why is she being such a killjoy? Why is this how you're portraying women? 98% of the time, it was an amazing experience, but it was hard for me to love the movie. Which is, I think we can say now, all fair and valid critique. But at the time, the response to her saying that was really ferocious. Mm-hmm. And it was part, I think, of what led to Heigl's downgrading in Hollywood. She was seen as, first of all, she was seen as ungrateful for saying these things about a movie that was her biggest career hit to date. And then after that, shortly, she was seen as difficult to work with. And that was a theme that sort of led to her larger characterization in Hollywood. What do you guys think of the response to this?
It's interesting to me that I think even a few years later. Maybe I'm misremembering the exact amount of time. But that Judd Apatow said that he had been expecting an apology.
Yeah. Like,
and it's always interesting.
Of course
to
he
me.
Had been.
Right, of course. But the idea of saying publicly that you were expecting an apology from somebody is just like an interesting thing to me to begin with.
Yeah.
But, you know, what would that apology have been for exactly? Mm, and I would have loved like some further articulation of that, right? Was it for calling the movie sexist at all? Was it for doing that in public? Was it for not being sufficiently happy with this role that she had been given? Was it for saying, you know, that 2% of the time it was not an amazing experience, right? That like 98% of the time it was an amazing experience is like quite the qualifier to have in a quote about, you know, feeling some level of difficulty with how women are portrayed in this film, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, again, still something that he not just expected an apology about, but told people as much. And that was really interesting to me.
Yeah.
I sort of realized that like we in some ways are casting ourselves as the Debbies and the Allisons by reading so much into this, and as we should, I think. Yeah. But also, you know, you also would like for your comedies to just be fully funny. And, you know, there are ways that I want this movie just be funny and to have, you know, that kind of classic Abbotovian combo of like humor and heart and have that be that. You know, so I was trying to think through, well, you know, maybe I'm misreading, and maybe, you know, maybe the movie is doing something more interesting than would seem. And so I thought, you know, maybe there's a way to read the absence of abortion in particular, and, you know, all the stuff that we've been talking about, all the kind of jump cuts and edit outs and all that kind of stuff. Like, maybe that is the movie trying to sort of suggest that Allison's decision is so much her own business that it is not the business of the audience, that, you know, the movie is going to sort of honor her selfhood and personhood and, you know, decision itself by not showing that to us, you know. And I would like to think that, but then per your question, Sophie, about the moments, you know, that sort of stick out, I mean, again and again, this movie does not seem to care about her right to privacy. The movie, you know, again and again, you know, violates her privacy when it comes to particularly her body. So, you know, the scene of the labor with, you know, the crowning moment where her body and its maximal moment of pain is, you know, presented full frontal to the audience, and it is played for laughs. And we know that she has not had an epidural and she is just in agony. And again, that's presented as comedy. And so this is just a long-winded way of saying, you know, I tried to give this movie the benefit of the doubt in that regard, but could not in the end because of that sort of accumulation of scenes and violations. So
that's what makes the angry defensiveness, I think, so hard for me to take, because like no one wants to be forced into the role of Debbie. Like I love Debbie actually in lots of ways, but like you don't want to be forced into the role of the woman who's always complaining about things. Do you know what I mean? But at the same time, like stuff like this does matter. It does have an impact.
I feel like comedy as a genre does what the movie did to Ben, which is rationalize, which is tell you that you shouldn't take it too seriously. Like it insists that his heart is in the right place, that like the movie itself is fundamentally a good guy. You know, like that's sort of what comedy does. It's, you know, like genres do have kind of a moral valence to them, and comedy itself in emphasizing laughter and low stakes kind of says with every scene, like, don't take this too seriously. You would be wrong and overreading to take it seriously. But I think that's also what gives it its power as a sort of pernicious force, because it sort of disarms you as a viewer from taking it too seriously, from treating it certainly as political, which like this movie, my goodness, is very definitely political. And yet it's sort of claims that it isn't, you know, and I think that's why the three of us are having such strong reactions to it, because it's not presented as a drama. It's not presented as anything but an excuse for laughter. And that makes its sort of messaging, I think, all the more powerful. And the word I keep using, pernicious, because that's what it is. And it is emitting messages to, you know, the millions of people who have seen this movie over the years and will continue to see it. And I think that's why it's worth considering, even if it does make us Debbie, literal Debbie Downers.
Debbie Downer, oh my God. Well, maybe we can end. Let's end with game.
We're fun with promise. Yay.
No. Yay. But I did want to ask you guys about films that have done a better job portraying women's reproductive choice, shall we say, or perhaps just portraying abortion, because there have been several of them, more than several. The one I've been thinking about recently amid the Roe news is Dirty Dancing, and its portrayal of Penny's character and her illegal abortion, which leaves her in agony and almost bleeding to death and terrified that she's going to be sterile. It's a subplot in the movie, we should say, in this like otherwise very like sweet, endearing coming of age romantic tale. But it's I think for many young women and men, it's one of their first experiences of a portrayal of abortion in a mainstream movie. And I think the way in which it's treated, is striking for the era that the movie was made in, from the, you know, it's from the 80s. Like, Penny is not demonized for her choice. Like, it's presented as a choice that she in many ways has to make as a dancer. She has very few options on the table. The man who has gotten her pregnant is callous and awful, to say the least. So I don't know. I think it's one that's aged surprisingly well for me. What about you two?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think Dirty Dancing is such a good portrayal of so many things. The one that occurred to me, that's my take on things, including dance and the time of your life in general. So the one that occurred to me is one that it came out in 2015, and in my mind anyway, did not get a lot of attention, and I think is definitely, you know, relevant again. It's a movie called Grandma, and it is this very small, I think in the best of ways, film about an 18-year-old who finds herself in need of an abortion, and she goes to her grandmother to take her to the appointment. So it's effectively a road trip type of film in the manner of Thelma and Louise, except with a grandmother and granddaughter. And I should say that very crucially, the grandmother is played by Lily Tomlin. The granddaughter is played by Julia Garner. The acting in this movie, as you might suspect, is just phenomenal, but also the writing is phenomenal. And I think particularly because even though in a very literal sense, the plot leads up to and revolves around this medical procedure, what it really is this very nuanced and very lovely character study of these two people together. And, you know, there's something so intimate about two people in a car together just talking, and, you know, the way that all the good things about that sort of trope in theater is realized in this movie. And I think it's, for all the things it says and all the things it doesn't, I think this movie is really lovely and beautiful. So Grandma from 2015 would be my thought.
Hannah, what about you?
Well, as ever, I'm thinking about Portrait of a Lady on Fire. which, you know, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is, of course, a romance, but I think in a lot of ways, it's also just a movie about how women help each other survive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's really just like a subplot, like a small part of the movie about the sort of the young housemaid, Sophie, who learns that she's pregnant. And she sort of describes it really like matter-of-factly. Like she just says, you know, like, I haven't had my period. And Marianne just asks like if she wants to have a baby. And when Sophie says no, you know, there's no big dwelling. There's no long exchange. There's no sort of real to-do about it. They just kind of set out to help her figure this out. And of course, the movie's set in the late 18th century. So the actual abortion scene happens in like an herbalist's home, and there's like a baby present, and there, you know, there's just this really sort of like beautiful ethereal quality about it. And then it's, you know, rendered in a painting. But the movie just plays it out as this really difficult, yes, but not just difficult moment, right? Like it's this way, it's something that happens that brings the three of them together, that brings you know, Marianne and Eloise together in a way, also because they're helping Sophie. And that's almost like the logical conclusion to what this young woman without much at her disposal would want in a moment like that. And I just thought it was really beautiful and poetic, and just appreciated the extent to which, again, like this is set obviously long, 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 long time ago. And yet there's a matter of factness that seems to evade a lot of modern, a lot of films set in modern times.
Yeah. Perfect picks, both of you. I'm excited for our upcoming abortion movie club, which I will now suggest. No, I'm just kidding. It's really striking that the both of your answers to those questions, I was like, yes, I need to watch those this weekend. Well, that does it for the show. The review is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from AC Valdez. The executive producer of Atlantic Podcast is Claudine Abade, and our art is by Charlie Le Mignon. I'm Sophie Gilbert. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you.
We will be back next week.